Welcome to Let's Talk Land, a weekly land education talk show devoted to learning about land and farms, buying and selling, ownership, especially for real estate agents and realtors. Learn from the experts, free land education. Hi, my name's Lou Jewell. I'm an accredited land consultant with United Country Real Estate. Sutton Properties, our new company name, along with our co-host, Teresa Martin, one of our agents who couldn't be here today. She's out selling real estate. Go, girl. Buying and selling homes, land and farms, want to auction your property in western Piedmont, North Carolina, southern Virginia, just give us a shout. We'll help you out. Our new office is at 102 East Main Street, next to BB&T Bank in downtown Pilot Mountain, North Carolina. Please make a note of our changes. Our company website now is www.allsuttonproperties, that's A-L-L-S-U-T-T-O-N properties.com. Just a program note, Dr. Barbie's Ask the Doctor show will now follow this show and will air at 10 a.m., so make sure you stay tuned. Dr. Barbie always has something of interest, so make sure you stay tuned for his show. Hey, our guest today is Don Bell. Welcome, Don.
Hello, Lou. How are you today?
Calling from beautiful downtown Asheville, North Carolina. Don's with NAI, which is a national commercial franchise, Beverly Hanks Realtor Commercial Broker Association. And our subject today, we're going to talk about landlocked land and easements. There's a lot of different people concerned about, is their property landlocked and what's it worth and how do you access it? And then there's 11 different types of easements. There's the good ones, Don, and there's the bad ones. So let me give a little background on you, Don, if I may. You grew up in the construction environment. Your father owned a successful residential commercial construction company in Ohio. Where in Ohio, Don?
It was actually a little north of Columbus in Delaware County.
So it was it kind of a rural area, rural farming area?
Yeah, it was a rural farming area. We grew up on a little family farm, raised a lot of our own produce as a young person. And but my father pretty much covered the western northwest part of Columbus and into Delaware and Delaware County.
Gotcha. So you guys had around 1,000 acres at one time?
Well, that was on a different farm that we owned in southern Ohio.
Okay.
And we used that they were putting a campground on it, and we used it for various other activities.
So you grew up loving the land just like I did. My grandfather, great-grandfather amassed over 18 farms between 1909 and 1921 in Surry County, North Carolina, just north of Dobson, the county seat. And we're almost five generations, Don, and not one inch of that's ever been sold to anyone outside the family. So we've got quite a tradition there.
That's pretty impressive.
But you enjoy hiking and photography and fly fishing and shooting skeet and bird hunting and kayaking, and just to mention a few things, you're a real outdoors person, and familiar with all aspects of real estate, from residential to development to investment to commercial land development, which all of those are different categories, and all those have unique characteristics and requirements. So, you know, it's good that you have that diversity. You work through the banking ranks from collections to branch manager, and then return to construction industry as a financial analyst and credit manager, handling project management and engineering profitability turnarounds. And of course, your natural open and friendly attitude combined with the energy of spirit compelled him to the marketing arm of business, and he achieved a great success with a move to Jacksonville, Florida, where he advanced with his profitability of several of his business's locations. His success was largely due to his strength in negotiating and problem solving. And you know, I tell my students, and you've been in my classes, you know, if we're not realtors and we're not real estate agents, we're professional problem solvers. And that's really what we do from the time it starts until we get it completed, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right.
But you've been in real estate for about 23 years now, mostly in western North Carolina, the Asheville area. And you got quite a practice up there, and you got quite a firm to work with. Beverly Hanks was founded, I believe, in 1976. And they've grown to be one of the largest full-service commercial broker firms in western North Carolina, plus they're huge in residential as well. How many offices do you guys have in the residential side?
We have 7 offices, right around 400 brokers, and I think last year we closed, as a firm, $1.5 billion in real estate.
That's B with a B, right? Billion.
B with a B. That's an M. That's a B.
That's great. And then on the commercial side?
Commercial side, we did about 65 to 70 million, something in that range.
And you just have the one office, or you have several in? How many
we
agents?
We have the one office, but the way our company is structured, each location has one or two commercial agents in that office that will also do residential work. And there are a few agents that are then specifically dedicated to full-time commercial. And, of course, I'm one of those, but I am the only one in our firm that does nothing but land.
Good for you. Where'd you learn that from?
I think I learned that from Lou Jewell.
We go back a few days, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Just to finish, NAA Global supports about 6,700 professionals with about 375 offices worldwide. It's quite an organization. They've got an incredible reputation, and I'm sure you're very pleased to be part of them.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a good firm to work through and a good franchise to work through.
And the way we kind of got together, I think you took one of my classes, but, you know, we have chapters for the Realtors Land Institute nationwide. We have 18 scattered around the country, and our chapter is the Carolinas chapter, RLI Carolinas chapter, which is North Carolina and South Carolina. And I've been on that board, God, over 20-some years. I just kind of stay as secretary and treasurer, and I've been president twice. And, of course, you're our vice president this year, and hopefully next year we'll move you up the ranks and be our president for our chapter. So thank you for being part of a group of dedicated folks that love land.
It's an honor and a privilege.
So let's talk about landlocked land. What can you tell me?
Wow.
Or what do you want to tell me?
Well, I'll tell you. Landlocked land is it's a mess. It's like going out with the blonde prom queen but never being able to touch her. It is a problem that exists in real estate when transactions are not handled properly at the front end for access, and people end up fighting and feuding and worse things than that to solve the problem and try to get back into a property that you cannot legally access. That's what landlocked means. There is no direct legal access to a public street. And the only way that you can get to it is by going through someone else's property at their beckoning. So it's a problem in our market.
Yeah. I've had a few occasions in my career where clients have come to me. And, you know, the way this usually happens, you know, going back to like my grandfather's farm, a family farm, you know, there were 10 children, mother being the oldest girl, born in 1911. But at his demise back in the 60s and my grandmother's, they divided the property up. Now, in this particular case, it all had road frontage, but typically we'll see, Don, or at least I do, when a family breaks up property, especially if you go way back, you know, the old farm road that went from the front to the back and now it's two parcels or three parcels, you know, it was family. So they didn't do an easement, you know, it was family. You just come across the land, it doesn't matter. Well, then years later, one of them in the back or in the middle decides to sell their property, and technically they're landlocked because there's no legal access that was created. And that's where I see a lot of it. Is what do you see out there?
Well, it's pretty much the same thing. It's we have that particular situation. You also have situations where families have decided to sell off parcels. They establish some type of access by virtue of deed, but it wasn't completed properly, so they left maybe a 15-foot stretch untitled or no easement to that, but they used it continuous, so nobody ever questioned it until it went into the commercial realm, and that's where a lot of these things start to show their problems, is when people want to develop, you know, apartment communities, residential development, apartments, warehouses, they start to do these title searches and they discover the imperfection on title. Or the other way that I've seen that's been malicious is that one neighbor knowingly had granted granddad a prescriptive easement, but they were using it freely, and the families changed hands. You know, older ones died, younger ones took over, and there was a squabble. The neighbor would intentionally not grant further access because it wasn't required to by law.
Right.
It wasn't on the deed.
Right.
So that's kind of the bad side of landlocked properties, is we see people getting vendettas out against their neighbors.
Yep, and that's what most of it is. It's ugly sometimes. You know, the definition of one of them for landlocked refers to the property that has no direct access from a public street or road. So the only way on or off the property is to cross the land owned by someone else, which is what we talked about. Usually landlocked property gains street access through a legal permission called an easement. And we're going to get into those easements here in the show, too. There's quite a few of them. And there's, like I said, there's good ones and there's bad ones. But I know I had one situation. It was an attorney, actually, that had bought a piece of land and accessed it for a number of years. And the property that he was going across was sold to another party, and they put a gate up and put signs up, no trespassing. And he called me up and wanted me to list it. And once I started doing the title work and stuff on it, I found out that there was never an access granted to it, and referred him back to another attorney. He was a different type of attorney. But I said, you're going to have to get an attorney. This is probably going to have to go to court. So I never did follow up. He never called me back, so I don't know if he ever got it resolved or not. But in terms of value, how would you value a piece of land that's landlocked, or would you put a value on it?
Nothing's ever worth nothing. Land has always got some kind of value to it. I would say if I've got a piece of property that market value, we'll pick a number, $300,000, if it's worth $300,000 on open market with full access, you know, I would say a landlocked same track would be worth maybe 25% of that to a third of that, or 75 to 100,000.
Right.
Because it does have value, but
right.
a lot of the value comes in the access, as you know.
Right. And some of the things that we run into, Don, I know I have, is you'll have these narrow easements. There'll be an easement there, but it may be only 14 feet.
Right.
So now you want to go, you know, get a loan on the land, or you want to get a construction loan and improve the land, build on it. And the bank say, you know, we need at least, I know Farm Credit, they've always given me allowance for 18 feet. But some of these lenders, you know, they want 30, even 45 feet. So, you know, unless you can resolve that, you know, you can't market that property to that particular use for that buyer. You know, you have to limit the uses of it. So,
right.
Or get the adjoining owners. I know I had one. It wasn't landlocked, but it had a 14-foot easement that serviced it, and it was, I think it was like six locks off of a state road on a graveled road. And their son and daughter-in-law had bought 30 acres all the way at the end of it. And, of course, the original easement was 14 feet, but the bank says we can't give you a construction loan unless you get at least 30. So they got what was called an exclusive easement. That easement was for them and them only. Even though I'm selling his parents the little three-acre tract that this easement goes across. And, of course, they were cash buyers. And I said, look, guys, I said, you know, you may want to see if we can get this easement expanded for you, because if you ever want to get a construction loan or resell the property, you know, you're going to run into some problems. So before we conveyed that property, we went through that process and actually got them a 30-foot easement. So, you know, didn't have to have it. Wasn't necessary. But, you know, as realtors, we got to advise people, you know, highest and best use.
You save people time and money down the road by being proactive on the front end.
You get it cleaned
up. Solving a problem before it exists.
Yep, you get it cleaned up. So.
And you know, I've got a listing now that we've gone through the legal channels to at least get a 12.5-foot cart path that a neighbor knowingly and openly blocked access. Because they didn't want another apartment complex going in next to their apartment complex. So we took some creative measures and were at least able to resecure, because of prescription or necessity, if you want to use that one, to get the property accessible to a main public road for private use, but it'll never go commercial until we solve that problem through expanding it, whether we do a court litigation or they do it by agreement.
Okay, this is our guest today, Don Bell. This is Let's Talk Land. So just to finish up landlocked land, you know, how do you get an easement for landlocked land? Well, the easiest ways to gain access to landlocked property is to obtain an expressed easement from the neighboring landowner. This easement should be in writing signed by the grantor, the person giving it, specifically to identify the property and details allow the easement's use and filed with the Register of Deeds. Now, one thing in this paragraph that I pulled out, it didn't mention anything about a survey, but, you know, you're going to need to get a survey done so you've got something that can be recorded for
Absolutely.
The future.
Well, and you also need to record the easement.
Exactly. So for, you know, in my classes, Don, you know, I teach and have been teaching the Land 101 class, a 16-hour, two-day course for the Realtors Land Institute since 2003, and I travel around the country as chapters provide our different one of our 10 courses to their membership. I just did one last year in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and then followed up with one in your backyard at Asheville. We had one heck of a class. That was one of my best classes. And then I created a four-hour CE class called Introduction to Land Brokerage. That is the only land class offered in the state of North Carolina on the subject of land to keep your license. Continuing education is elective. And I'm finding out I'm the only one in the country. Just not a lot of people are interested in learning about land or teaching about it. But we keep pushing on, don't we, buddy?
Yeah, we do. You got to educate.
But one of the things, and I made a copy, you have it as well, that I use in both of my classes, Don, is a dissertation that was actually done by the North Carolina Bar Association as accredited CE class for the attorneys on the subject of easements. And it is quite comprehensive. And I actually go over this whole thing, which hopefully we can get through part of it today, in my classes. And it's probably one of the most important aspects of learning about land brokerage and knowing all of these different types of easements and how they apply. So if you'd like to help me out today, let's see if we can go through that and help some folks out there, okay?
That's awesome. Let's do it.
So the definition of an easement is just a non-possessory right on the holder of an easement to make some use of land. Sorry. In other words, an easement is a lesser interest in a fee estate that allows the party benefiting from the easement to make some use of the property, such as using it for access, insulation of utility lines, and so on. So I always explain an easement to my students as a contract. It's a contract for something for something. So it's actually a contract where I agree to sell you or lease you or, you know, some type of benefit, the right to come across my property to access your property. So it is a contract. But, you know, you basically have a dominant person versus a subservient. The dominant would be the person that you're allowing, that's allowing the access, and the servant is the person that's gaining the access. It says the holder of an easement right or property that is benefiting from the easement is referred to as a dominant tenant. Likewise, the property benefiting from an easement is referred to as a dominant estate or dominant tenement. The party burdened by the easement is referred to as the servant tenant. Likewise, the property burdened by the easement is the servant estate or servant tenement. And then exclusive easement versus non-exclusive easements. And we gave an example of that earlier. Because an easement right is non-possessory, it generally does not allow the party benefit by the easement to exclude others to stop them from also enjoying the property. In other words, easements are generally non-exclusive. However, easements can be specifically granted as an exclusive easement, allowing the holder of the easement right to ability to exclude others. Now, just an example that I have, and I'm sure you've got a couple too. Say I've got a landlocked piece of property, and I have it's a timber tract. Well, in North Carolina, and each state basically has the same laws, but you won't always want to check with your jurisdiction where you live. But if I wanted to harvest that timber, then the court, if the access is not granted by the neighbor, I can actually go to court and get a temporary easement to harvest that timber. And most courts will award that because it is a crop and it is has value. So that's kind of an example of that. You have any examples of that?
Yeah, I mean, another good example would be someone who wanted to put, had a family farm that was landlocked, and they wanted to access that, so they decided they would put in a corn crop. It has to earn, if I understand it correctly, there has to be a certain amount of revenue that's generated in order for that to continue perpetual as a farm. But I've seen that before. I've seen folks that decided they wanted to put beehives in and could prove in court that it harmed them if they didn't have access, and therefore were granted a temporary easement that they tried to turn into a permanent easement, which is a whole different story. But
exactly.
That's a good starting point.
Yeah. And then you got what's called a pertinent easement, or easements in gross. And that a pertinent easement is an easement that is intended to benefit a particular piece of land, a dominant estate or tenement, rather than a particular individual. In this case, there's also a servant easement tenement, the land over which the dominant estate has its easement rights. And examples, an easement is granted to, say, shopping mall parcel for access across the neighboring property's owner's private road in order to allow the shopping mall customers to get from the shopping mall parking lot to the street. This is an easement of appurtenant to the shopping mall parcel, which is the dominant estate, and then the neighbor who's granted an easement owns the servant estate. So are you seeing that in some of your commercial properties?
Yeah, I see it quite a bit, actually. We've got one case right now where we have an easement through a shopping center with a resident behind it, but the easement is, it's sort of vague. It states it on deed, but it doesn't state location. So that's another type of easement, but something like that.
Right. So the intent is to benefit the holder of the easement's right, but the holder's right is used, may well enhance the value of the property she, in this case, uses in connection with her exercise of the easement right. An example, Jim grants Sally an easement to fish in his pond, which is located on his privately owned property. As part of the easement right, Sally's also granted an easement to enter into Jim's property to go to and from the pond. While Sally may live next door, she may move miles away, and the easement follows her, not her property. This is an easement in gross, since Sally is a dominant tenant, Jim is a servant tenant. Jim owes the servant estate with the pond on it. There is no dominant estate. So we'll see that once in a while, too, especially in the rural areas. But most easements also come across the commercial real estate transaction or appurtenant easements. And those are easements by implication, or what they call quasi-easements, which is under narrow circumstances the court may imply the easement as a matter of law requires the court finding that the parties had intended to create an easement but simply failed to do so expressively. An implied easement can be created only when the grantor conveys a portion of the real estate he owns or when he divides the larger tract among separate grantees. In either case, the servants of parcel occurs, which is a necessary prerequisite to an implied easement. Are you seeing any of those at all?
Not too many. Most of what I see are the ones where they're landlocked just by virtue of I forgot.
Right.
So I don't see too many of these because Asheville seems to have a little better handle on making sure that we don't landlock each other.
Right. This is something you'll see once in a while, too, an easement that can be implied at time of severance only if the easement used existing prior to the severance. Susie owns two lots, one of which fronts the street and one which is landlocked. Susie's driveway crosses both lots. Susie decides to keep the landlocked parcel and sell off the frontage parcel. Susie forgets to reserve the driveway easement for egress to her parcel in order for Susie to establish that implied easement should be created. One of the prerequisites, Susie must have proved that she used the driveway located in the front property to access the property prior to conveying it. So you know, when you go to court with these different types of situations, you know, you got to get some history on it. And that's real important in making the decisions.
I've got one like this where the sister and the brother were fussing at each other. The brother owned the frontage property. Sister owned it. She wanted to let her gain access through his property. Ultimately, they got back together, and she decided he would buy her out, and that solved the problem. But it's not uncommon to see this type of an easement problem.
Exactly. And we're just touching the surface on some of these, you know.
Oh, yeah.
There's a lot of them. And then, of course, you got easement by necessity. That's when property is divided in a way that leaves a part of the property without access to the road or landlocked in that case, easement of egress and egress. Way by necessity is implied across the other parts. An easement by necessity exists only as long as they need exist. In other words, if the landlocked property later has direct access from another public road, then the prior implied easement by necessity will go away. So, you know, sometimes DOT and the, you know, highways they build and they move. And, boy, they're the ones that create a lot of this landlocked stuff. I mean, it's crazy some of the things they do. And in the past, they don't do it much anymore. But it's not unusual to, you know, to list a piece of property, maybe 50, 40, 50, 100 acres, doesn't matter. It could be 5 acres. And across the road is this little strip that you own. But it landlocks the person behind it.
Right.
And, of course, it's not worth anything. You can't build anything on it. It's only good to the person that has been landlocked or portion of the land cut off. So, you know, we see that quite a bit. And usually when we get in that situation, we recommend to the seller that we go ahead and convey, either just give it to them or for a small amount, go ahead and convey that little strip of property across the road just to clean that up. So,
and I've also found that NCDOT will do their best to clean up a mess like that when they create that type of problem. If you get with the right department, they seem to be very willing to help things that they have created by just error.
And a lot of this stuff, you know, you see that was done back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, you know, like that. It's not, you know, a lot of the new highway construction stuff, I think they're more careful to go ahead and, when they're buying land for accessibility for highway development, they're going ahead and making sure all of that stuff's cleaned up so we don't have those problems in the future. Hopefully they're doing that.
Yeah.
Don, you got another one. It's called easement by prescription.
Mm-hmm.
It's analogous to an adverse possession, complicated concept, but the bottom line is that an easement by prescription, it eventually flows the line through that and has been used for so many years for this purpose. An easement, though not expressly created, was created by prescription. For example, Joe's property is located between Sally's home and the park. Every day, Sally walks across Joe's property with her dog, like Shadow over there, to get to the park. Every day, Sally walks back from the park across Joe's property back home. Sally's been doing this for 30 years. Very old dog. Sally's argument is that she's had an easement by prescriptions which would flow from this type of property. In fact, so that's what we call a prescriptive easement too. I mean, that's what we're talking about, and that's where you go to court and say, you know, we've been using this road, you know, continuously. It's 20 years is what we have here in North Carolina. I think they're looking for as a minimum that you've been accessing your property and no one's engaged you for any reason, and therefore, you know, the court's probably going to go ahead and grant that easement. Are you seeing much of that in your area?
Yeah, we've got one case. I just closed on the property. A mining company bought this property on the Tow River up in Yancey County, and they had an easement across an adjoining parcel to get access to their mining site down by the river. And it has taken us at least a year to dig through records and try to figure out what's the best way to solve it. And it ended up, it's going to be probably an easement by necessity to a guy who wanted to own the acreage. He bought it before we finished our research on it, but it's solvable through that method.
Right.
Just digging back into records that go way back into the 30s to find out why the property should be granted access by virtue of necessity or possession.
Right. Our guest today is Don Bell, and this is Let's Talk Land. So let's talk about affirmative and negative easements. Easement is affirmative when it entitles the dominant tenant to use the servant tenant for a particular purpose, such as Sally's right to use Jim's fishing pond that we talked about earlier. An easement is negative when it entitles the dominant tenant to prevent the servant tenant from using the property in a particular way. For example, if Ralph gave Carol an easement with a view corridor, and you guys have a lot of that up there in the high hills,
right,
across Ralph's property, such that Carol can view the lake, would never get blocked. Ralph cannot build a tall structure, wall, or other obstruction, or allow a structure such as trees to hinder Carol's rights under the view corridor easement. This is referred to as a negative easement. Carol's view corridor rights allows her to compel Ralph not to do something. So, you know, you guys have actual special laws up there in your part of the world, don't you, on these ridgetop views?
Absolutely do. You know, we've got, you can't build structures over a certain number of feet due to what we call the slope ordinance, or it forces builders to keep their properties low so that it doesn't affect, A, the view, and also doesn't overbuild on slope, so you have a bunch of runoff problems.
Right.
But it's pretty common here.
Now, is that just in the county you're in, or is that several counties in the mountain area?
Well, that's several counties. Buncombe has them. Henderson has them. I don't know about Madison County or Yancey, but those are the two dominant counties in our area, Buncombe and Henderson. And so it's fairly common to challenge builders to keep things under a particular height so that it doesn't affect you.
And if you want to find out, you can actually go to your county courthouse or county website and look for subdivision laws, and that's probably where you would find that with all the explanations.
Yeah, BuncombeCounty.org is a good spot to go to, and HendersonCounty.org, I believe, is their site as well.
Mm-hmm. So one of the questions in this presentation is, how are easements created? Number one, they're either expressed language or grant, and the most common method of granting an easement is by deed or written conveyance. I grant you a non-exclusive perpetual easement across the westernmost 10 feet of my property would be an example, or by reservation in conveying a land by deed if a grantor wants to reserve certain easement rights. Another way to create the easement is by reservation. Quote, I convey fee interest in lot one to you, grantee, but I grantor reserve the non-exclusive easement in the ingress and egress over the driveway located on lot one. Of course, this is less common but perfectly acceptable in a manner of creating easements. Then you got
that non-exclusive is, I see that more and more, and it's becoming a problem.
Yep.
Because it doesn't say where the dominant access is.
Exactly. You know,
it just says we're giving you a non-exclusive easement, and we can put it wherever we want. So I think whenever someone's doing an easement, they need to clean up the wording so that it becomes a specific site as opposed to a non-exclusive site.
I agree with you, and it definitely should be surveyed and located on the ground.
Yep.
I did a show last year, I think it was, on forensic surveying with one of my surveyors, which was quite interesting. And one of the things that he talked about is, like, you've got a piece of farmland, and, of course, it was divided up. And part of it was cultivated back in the 30s and 40s and crops. And then, of course, they let it lay fallow, and then trees grew up. And then, you know, here we are with the 30-year growth of trees and no visible evidence of where that old farm road was that went to connect to the back of the property. So part of the forensics methodology is going to the Agricultural Extension Department, because they used to annually fly over all of the croplands and take photographs, and that's how they would determine acreage. They calculate it. So by going back and finding the old slides or pictures or photographs of this particular property back in the period when that road was being used, then the surveyor could actually take that aerial map and actually locate that original access on the ground and create an easement and get it recorded. So that's one way to solve the problem, I guess.
Yeah.
And then there's easements distinguished from licenses. An easement and license are similar property interests, but there are some important distinctions. An easement in general are perpetual or non-revocable, right, while a license is often revocable and is typically limited duration. An easement is insurable from title insurance standpoint, while a license is not typically insurable. That's talking about title insurance. An easement is typically recorded, where a license is not typically recorded. And generally speaking, an easement is more powerful property interest than a license. The requirements for creating an easement is generally the same as deed formalities. When these formalities are not compiled with, the grantee has merely a license, a written instrument signed by the grantor delivered to the grantee. Easements are also typically recorded, which provides notice to third parties and to the public. Do you see many of those? I mean, that's I really haven't in my almost 30 years of land brokerage. Again, we were talking about crops.
I don't see any license at all. Yeah. You know, it's not something that's real common. I typically only see the easement that we're discussing.
Right, me too. I would assume this would be more for like a crop situation or temporary access to maybe remove dirt or sand from a creek or something, you know.
Yeah, and that would typically be drawn up in a lease situation.
Right, farm lease.
And it's temporary, as it states, you know, that.
Right.
You don't see it very often, and most of it is just implied. It's not really even drawn up anymore.
Sure.
We've got several of those where they've had 30-year agreements. And nobody ever put it in writing.
No, they just shook hands like we used to do it in the old days.
Right.
Then you got examples of certain types of easements. You've got a short-form utility easement. You got easements for egress and egress over someone's property. You got cross-access or reciprocal easements for the and maintenance agreement. You got shared driveways, shopping center parking areas, construction easements, conservation easements, easements for light and for air, no common law right to light or view, learn how to grow mushrooms, okay? Then you got air rights. You'll see that in your urban areas, you know, your large cities. And then you got condominium and town hall declarations and declarations of covenants, conditions, restrictions, and easements. Shopping malls, REAs, and mixed-use high-rise declarations for CC and Rs. And then one of the most existing easements, one of the most important jobs of a real estate lawyer, and of course for us too as real estate agents, has during the title and survey review period contract due diligence is to identify the existing easements, both benefiting and burdening the property that is the purchase of acquiring. Now, I know you do this, and we both advocate this. I definitely do this in my class. It's when you go and preview a property about listing it and actually list it, you want to go ahead and pull those deeds and back deeds and start looking for problems, get copies of title policies that make exceptions, and really familiarize yourself with any potential problems and hopefully get those cleaned up before you put them on the market, because you don't want to, you know, when you put it on the market, it should be ready to sell. And not take 6 or 9 months to create, to fix.
Well, I think the key to that is, yes, we can do all of our due diligence work and try to understand the property, but the real estate lawyers play a critical
Absolutely.
Role in how you and I can move forward on a piece of property, even to list it. Without their benefit, and that's the only authority that we should go to anyway.
Absolutely.
We're not authorities in this matter. Attorneys are.
Nope.
So I think that's something that every real estate agent needs to access consistently if they're going to do land business.
Absolutely.
Have a good real estate attorney that understands land problems and title issues relative to access.
Yep. I use mine all the time. Anytime I see something, I've got two or three that I give a lot of business to, and I can call them at home on Saturday night too and say, hey, I got this situation. Can you take a look at it and advise me and the client before we go forward with this? So whether easement benefits or burdens the property or both, if it benefits the property, make sure the easement is added as an insured parcel under the title policy. And if not insured and the purchaser is somehow deprived from its use of the easement, the purchaser will have no recourse against the title company. Very important. Very important. It's in bold.
Yep.
If it burdens the property, determine at what extent, location, et cetera. Identify the type or nature of the easement. Is it a utility easement or an access easement? Is the easement critical to the use of the property? And you may need full understanding of the purpose of the easement and its functions, who is benefited, whether it is necessary, et cetera. And then ascertain the location of the easement. And, of course, this is, again, in bold, critical elements of the title and survey view. If the easement is, say, a sewer line maintenance easement, make sure it is not located under any improvements, and we'll see that from time to time. And if it's located under existing improvements, you must look at to the language of the easement to determine whether it is a problem. Typically, any time an easement runs under improvement, that is a problem. Then you want to identify the party has the maintenance obligations, if any, because you want to know who's responsible. And the easement in a cross-access easement for a driveway, someone needs to maintain the driveway, repave it, plow it, et cetera. Typically, a cross-easement will obligate one of the parties to perform the maintenance, and the other party will share. Good luck on that sometimes.
Yeah. If it ain't in writing and you don't have a fund set up for it, chances of it happening are pretty slim.
Well, even if it is in writing, sometimes people just won't perform what their obligations are, and, you know, that creates another problem. So. Identify why there's any cost payment obligations associated with an easement. Some examples regarding cross-access easements for a driveway. Now, you see this a lot, Don, you know, in these in rural land developments where, you know, in North Carolina for most of our jurisdiction, as long as we stay 10 acres or more when we're subdividing property, i.e., say 50 acres or 100 acres in a 10-plus acre tract, usually, you know, I'm a dirt road developer, so, you know, I used to use the existing old farm roads and then work off my my breakouts from my tracks off of those roads and then just improve them. But they would always put a road maintenance agreement. Who's responsible for keeping that road up, you know, for the future? So, you know, a lot of times we see that, too, and we need to be aware of that. Does easement prove the right to obtain an estoppel from the other party to the easement? Sometimes easement, particularly in the complex enough, contains rights to obtain an estoppel from another parties to that easement to verify that all fees are current, all maintenance have been performed, and there's no disputes and no pending litigations. Is there any way to get rid of a burdensome easement or somehow obtain title company relief? You know, that's a question you got to look at. Termination, does it have a time clock on it? Utility of ownership, merger, operation of law, valid written releases, abandonments, lapse of time easements due to duration, such as temporary construction easements, end of necessity by default, and invalidity. In the case of easement by prescription, failure by the dominant tenant, brief party Sally walking her 30-year-old dog, Shada, to object to an unreasonable interference with the easement by the servant tenant. Joe erects a fence across the easement area, or a third party in the dominant tenant, Sally, fails to enforce the right of the easement to go away. So, you know, like I said, easements is probably one of the hardest things that we have to deal with in land brokers. Don't you agree?
I would agree. You get more problems with that because it does limit. If you have a cart path easement, for example, something that's narrow, it limits that property's ability, and it also then would affect its value.
Right.
If you've got a 12.5-foot or a 14-foot width drive or easement into the property, you can't run out and find a developer that wants to put a 200-unit apartment complex in there because the county standards are going to say 45 to 60 feet.
Right.
It's not there. So your land value is greatly affected by that.
Yep, it reduces your highest and best use. You know, it's limits.
Absolutely
your,
does.
Yep. And we're about done with easements, but we want to get into drones here a little bit at the end. I'm very excited about it, and thank you for bringing that up. Easements that run with the land. Running with the land, that don't mean you're out there. Running with the land is a phrase that means that no matter who owns the real estate, the easement or covenant benefits or burdens the successor owner of the property. In other words, a beneficial easement that runs with the land will benefit future owners, while a burdensome easement that runs with the land will burden future owners in discussion of the pertinent easements and easements engrossed. The pertinent easement runs with the land of both the benefited, dominant, and the burdened servant estate and the tenements. The easement engrossed will run with the land as far as the burdened servant estate tenement is concerned, but it will not run with the land to benefit the dominant estate or tenant because an easement engrossed is personal in nature and is not tied to the benefit of the party's ownership. And personal easements, they are easements engrossed as discussed above. The following, they follow the person, not the real estate. So when you convey that property to a third, another party, then that particular type of easement is ended unless the new tenants want to create other arrangements. Enforcement, an easement and property right, and the benefited party has the right to enforce it just as they would have the right to enforce a deed conveyance or any other type of land grant. If the nature of the enforcement is such that the benefited estate party is trying to compel the burdened estate or party to honor the rights granted by the easement, the best avenue of protection is making the title claim contemporaneously with, a demand from the other party to the easement. A necessary prosecutor to make sure that the title claim is that the easement was insured under the title policy. If the nature of the enforcement is such that the burdened party is trying to compel the benefited party to comply with the terms of easement, such as paying necessary share of maintenance costs, you would seek compliance like you would with any other contractual dispute. And then finally, some easements provide an arbitration as an alternative dispute for resolution the mechanism. So is there any other type of easement that we didn't cover?
None that I think would the average user would understand, and some of them I even get confused with.
Me too, as well, my friend.
Because there's so many different things and ways that you can gain access. The landlocked problem, I think, is still something that needs to be dealt with by the legislature to see if we can't come up with a permanent solution to this. But I think that's something that will happen 100 years from now.
Sure. Well.
One thing that I think is really important for everybody to understand as well is that an easement, when you have a landlocked property and you come up with a solution, they typically are not free. You're going to have to come up with some dollars or something in exchange for access. And in a lot of cases, I've had attorneys tell me, if you want access with this parcel, it's going to cost your client $50,000 because of all the litigation that will cost us to go back and forth and prove our case.
Sure.
So this is not something that should be taken lightly if you decide to proceed in through legal proceedings, but always consult your attorney and get his best advice on the cost up front, because these things can stretch out for even years to solve.
Yeah, they can. Well, I think we did a good job on easements, Don. Tell me about what's going on in the drone market. You know, we use that quite a bit. I have for years, and I know you have as well. Give us some overview on what's going on and the importance of it and how it really affects marketing.
Yeah, the drone market has really started to take off in our world. I think in 2019 there were 1.05 million drones registered in the country. And I believe there were around 160,000 licensed commercial operators that are able to use their drones for commercial purposes. Some of the struggles that this industry is having is identifying who can and who cannot use a drone for commercial benefit.
Yeah, explain that for us.
Well, the commercial benefit means that if I take my drone out and I'm hired by a farmer who wants an aerial shot of his crops three times a year so he can tell the growth patterns, and then he gives me a $50 check every time I show up, I am required by the FAA to have a commercial drone license or a UAS operator's license. If I take any money in exchange for anything that I did with that drone, you must have a commercial license. That license is not hard to get. It requires a fair amount of study, $150, and a test.
Hmm.
That license is then good for 2 years, which after 2 years you go back in and you re-up or refresh your license with the FAA.
What kind of
hours? That's another $150.
What kind of hours are you talking about in your study material and testing?
I would say if you put in 10 to 20 hours of good hard study, that you should be able to pass the test. It's they've got some gotcha questions, but it's comprehensive. I mean, you need to understand pitch and yaw. You need to understand, how to calculate cloud cover. You need to understand wind loading and how far can I shoot my drone? What do I need to have visually? You know, some of the requirements, number one, you've got to have a line, always have your drone in line of sight, okay? Now, what a lot of operators are doing, and I'm watching a lot of videos on Facebook, is they'll launch their drone and they'll go out and they'll run 2 miles out. Well, that violates the FAA rule that you always have to have your drone in line of sight.
Right.
You can't do it with binoculars. It has to be with a naked eye.
Hmm.
So that's one of the things that people get tripped up on.
What kind of
penalty? You also should always have someone who's a visual observer. So there are going to be times when the operator, the pilot, takes his eyes off the drone to look at his computer screen or his iPad. And so the visual observer's always got that drone in sight so that if he's headed toward a tree or a building or a person, you kind of have it's a second warning system.
Right. What kind of penalties for people that are caught not following the rules?
I've seen penalties of $2,000 to $5,000 for a repeated offender, and I've seen penalties of $1,000,005 for someone who violates city standards.
Oh, my gosh.
So they can become pretty heavy-handed on people violating these rules and regulations of how to operate a drone. You can't operate it. It has to be during the daytime. You can't do it at 30 minutes before sunset and 30 minutes before sunrise.
Hmm.
A drone is like somebody in a speedboat. It must yield to all other aircraft.
Right. And there's height limitations too, right?
I'm sorry? There's height limit, yeah.
Yeah. What is that?
You can't go over 400 feet above ground level.
Right.
Or 400 feet above a structure.
Okay. Wow. What else? Well, how do you guys use it? I know how we use it, but explain to the public, what's the benefit if you have land you want to market it, especially large tracts?
Well, I think that from the standpoint of how do you use it best for the client to market, is finding that fine line between flying too low and flying too high and getting good still photography of sectors of a piece of property, or shooting low enough and doing a video so that I walk the property with the drone and the drone is able to take pictures of things that you would normally see with the eye, but you can't get there because you live in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and you're just looking at properties in your market. So the drone would then become a second set of eyes, maybe at 15 or 20 feet elevation, not at 150 feet, because you can't get topography, you can't get features at that elevation.
Right.
And a lot of drone operators are overshooting their photos and not giving a good pick or a good picture of what they see using that tool.
Are you overlaying the text map outline on your drones? So you can kind of see where the property boundaries are, as opposed to just taking pictures?
I haven't been doing that because I don't have a good software package to do it.
Right.
I do my own stuff.
Okay.
I don't have someone that I hire. I did get my license, and so I do shoot my own aerial stuff. So I'm fairly green on the application side. I've learned a lot about the law because you take the test. But application is the challenge. If you don't have a good software package to do your photography, it just doesn't turn out very good.
Sure. I got a good example for you, and I'm going to brag on my dog, Shadow, here, my Jack Russell. She sells more real estate than I do, Don, believe it or not. But several years ago, I had an opportunity to represent the Governor Stanley Furniture up in Martinsville, Virginia. The great-grandfather had, at one time, an 800 or 900-acre farm, lost it during the Depression. And years later, the governor started assembling parcels that had been sold previously and had amassed about a 350-acre tract, which had the 1820 original farmhouse on it with a separate kitchen outside, separate building. Corps of Engineers came in, had horse pastures, actually, the area in Martinsville in Henry County, and they had built a 27-acre water reserve on the property. It had the 1910, I believe it was, farmhouse that the governor was bought in, an old two-story typical farmhouse, and a 6,000-square-foot barn and two barns. And over the years, they took the pasture land. The great-great-grandfather was, and the grandfather were huge in cattle, and they planted it into plantation pines, which was over 200 acres in maturing pines. And I got my drone guy out there, and then, of course, I've got a GoPro, and I have Shadow come running up at the beginning, and a bubble pops up, and it says, "Hi, my name's Shadow. Follow me on the most incredible piece of property you'll ever lay your eyes on." And then through the video, you know, she's in the picture, out of the picture. And at the end, she comes up, and I set her on a boat that had been turned over, overlooking one of the ponds, and her tongue hanging out. She says, "You better call my dad, Lou Jewell, right now, 336-669-1405, because you don't want to miss this property. There's too many people in us. Call him right now." And dadgum, if I didn't get a phone call. I didn't have it on the market a week and actually ended up selling to the guy. But one
That's
of the,
incredible.
But one of the things.
Some of the new drones, you can literally tag a person with the drone, launch the drone, tag the person, and that person walking, that drone will follow that person like a dog on a leash.
That's crazy, isn't it? Well, actually, you probably could follow a dog on a leash, huh?
Yeah.
Shadow, we might want to try that. But, you know, one thing I did too, Don, I incorporated, I actually took the aerial topo map, with the floodplain, because you had a lot of water courses on this thing, big creek, of course, feeding that big lake. And I sandwiched that to the left visual. And then, of course, I've got the drone on the right visual. And then I've got an error on the overlay, on the topo map. And every time that camera moves, that little error moves on that property where that drone is or where you are. And if it pans left or pans right, that error is pointing. So as if you were standing there looking. And this takes you through the whole property. And I've been fortunate to sell property 2 and 3 hours away from my office, with an aerial sign out there with the information, with a QRC that you click on. It says property information, takes you right to the MLS sheet. You've got all the information and the disclosures. And then, of course, you've got the drone. I've got another QRC for the drone, so you click on that, and you can stand right there on the edge of the property and tour it without even setting foot on it. That's the way you sell land.
That's how you sell land. Technology is saving us a lot of time and keeping these old bodies going.
Absolutely. I'm actually going to start taking up golf. I haven't played since the 70s because I'm not walking as much land as I used to. So just briefly, with a little bit of time left here, what's going on in your local market up there? How's business?
Things were going pretty well until we hit this particular episode with the coronavirus, but Asheville is still on fire. Even with the sort of people limited to what they can do in the field, I'm busy. I've got developers calling me looking for land. They want to develop homes. They want to put in apartments. They want to do RV sites. They want to put in glamping sites. So Asheville is still a pretty active market, and I think we're going to pull through this episode we have right now in pretty good shape.
Yeah. We are, too. We've got the most property under contract that we've ever had. Of course, some of that was, prior to all this, but we're still selling every day, and that hasn't stopped us yet. And we're still getting prices. It's crazy. Let's take a second here and give us information on how people get in touch with you, Don. We want to make sure they know how to find you, buddy.
Well, I'm Don Bell. I'm with NAI Beverly Hanks out of Asheville, North Carolina. You can reach me on my cell at 828-275-8286, or you could email me at dbell, that's D-B-E-L-L, at NAI Beverly Hanks.com. I'm happy to help in any way I can with your needs up here in the mountains of Western North Carolina.
You won't find anybody better than my buddy Don. I tell you, you're quite a realtor up there and a good friend. And appreciate you coming on the show today. I really wanted to get into this easements, and you're the perfect person to talk about it. And, of course, landlocked land. And then we got a bonus today. We talked about drones. So, we want to use that technology. I tell my kids, as long as you live, I always be aware of the latest technology and use it and apply it and always be first. And that's what we try to do. So let's close this out, Roddy. Okay? Thank you for joining us today. Let us know how you like the show. If you have any guests or topics you'd like to suggest, we'd appreciate them. All questions are welcome, and all of our guests may be emailed with your questions or concerns as well. This show is for the public and, most importantly, for real estate agents who do not have a source of land education. All of our shows after their broadcast this morning will be downloaded on the master website, which is www.letstalkland.net, letstalkland.net, also on Podbeam and Spotify. And you can email me at lou@mylandpro.com. My cell number is 336-669-1405. Ronnie, how do they get in touch with us here at the station?
Well, they can go to our website, Lou. They can go to WKTE1090.com. And also, they can download the Simple Radio app and hear us anywhere in the world.
In the world. What about the universe?
The universe also.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, it gets thrown out there, huh?
It gets way, way out there.
So you can go to our website, right?
Right.
And you can download that app, or you can just go to your app thing.
Store, yeah.
Store, right, mm-hmm. and download that Simple Radio app.
Yeah.
And listen to Beach and Oldies only happy music.
That's right.
We only play happy music.
That's it. Got to keep everybody happy.
You got it. And we got some nice awards here.
Yes, yeah, 5 years in a row as being the station of the year. And also, then I got that Reader's Choice Award last year. 2019 for Announcer of the Year.
Announcer of the Year. Wonder why?
I don't know.
Oh, God. Well, thank you for joining us today. Stay tuned to Dr. Barbie.